we depended heavily on walrus, seal, and bowhead.
St. Lawrence Island asks for a disaster declaration for a record low walrus harvest. From the Alaska Public Radio Network, this is Alaska News Nightly for Wednesday, July 31st. Good evening, I'm Ellen Lockyer. Also tonight, training for the Olympics on Eagle Glacier.
We roller ski a lot, but actually moving on snow is a totally different feel. It's a different technique. So we're looking to make history, and this is kind of the groundwork of that history.
Those stories tonight on Alaska News Nightly.
Alaska News Nightly is brought to you in part by your local public radio station. Join Alaska bars and restaurants from every corner of the state in taking a stand against secondhand smoke. The fact of the matter is, no Alaskan, employee, or customer should suffer the heart disease and lung cancer due to secondhand smoke. The benefits are undeniably positive for Alaskans and for the bottom line. Clean indoor air. It's good for health, and it's great for business. For more information on smoke-free workplaces, visit alaskatca.org. This message sponsored by the Alaska Tobacco Control Alliance.
Congress is debating the funding levels for things that have huge effects on Alaska. The Environmental Protection Agency, Land and Water Conservation Funds, firefighting resources, and others. As APRN's Peter Granitz reports, the House is prepared to move a bill that makes dramatic cuts.
While July may be hot in Washington, D.C., it gets even hotter inside the Appropriations Committee rooms. July is historically Appropriations Month, the actual governing that Congress needs to do, debating how much to spend on every government agency. The House Appropriations Committee is finishing up its interior bill that would cut spending by $5.5 billion from the current fiscal year. Idaho Republican Mike Simpson chairs the Interior Subcommittee.
I don't like the fact that we've eliminated funding in this bill for the Woodrow Wilson Center. I don't like the fact that state and tribal wildlife grants are eliminated in this bill. I don't like the fact that the LWCF, Land and Water Conservation Fund, doesn't have funding in this bill.
Simpson is seen as a moderate by some in Congress, willing to cut deals. He's amenable and friendly, and he relishes a bit of showmanship. Even though he doesn't like those cuts, he says something larger gets under his skin, the $17 trillion deficit. He took out a stack of dollar bills, telling the committee to imagine they were hundreds instead of ones.
If you stack them on top of one another to get to $17 trillion, it would be a stack 10,500 miles high.
The House version of the bill cuts funding for the EPA by 34%. Appropriations Committee Chairman Hal Rogers is an old-school politician. The cigar-smoking Kentuckian says his committee, tasked with paying for the EPA, needs to rein in the agency, even though that's reserved for a separate committee.
These cuts will right-size this overzealous agency. Unfortunately, in recent years, enabled by excessive stimulus funding, the EPA has done more harm than good.
Democrats contend the cuts will harm the nation's water and air, a threat to future generations. The Interior Appropriations Bill actually increases funding for emergency wildfire fighting. The government is down to just 7 planes to fight fires scattered throughout Alaska and the rest of the country. Committee members say they hope to modernize the radar systems in the fleet. Over in the Senate, the Interior Appropriations Committee has yet to release its bill.
We're running out of daylight between now and the end of this fiscal year.
Senator Lisa Murkowski is the top Republican on the committee. Congress will return in September for just 9 legislative days before the end of the fiscal year. There is no hearing scheduled on the Senate version. Murkowski says she has not looked at the House plan in detail, but calls the House cuts tough.
I know that they're pretty dramatic, and they're probably not going to survive over here.
With so much distance between the two plans and so little time to do anything, what happens? Democrat Sam Farr, a liberal House member from California, calls the entire exercise a waste of time. He says Congress won't pass the appropriations bills and will resort to a continuing resolution to keep the government operating.
So if we want to have this race to the bottom, all we're going to guarantee is that we end up with a CR. And that's no way to govern. That means all the hard work that our committees do, and they all do in going over these budgets and marking up, is just thrown out the window year after year. I'm sick of it.
But to Farr, that's not half bad because it means the cuts don't happen, because the continuing resolution will keep the government open at current levels. In Washington, D.C., I'm Peter Granitz.
Gamble and Savunga had their lowest walrus harvest on record. That's created a food shortage and economic crisis in the Yupik villages as residents are unable to pay their bills and are worried about the upcoming winter. The region's legislators are urging Governor Parnell to declare an economic disaster declaration for the island to free up state money for relief. KNOM's Eva Dolap has more.
Gloria James is with the native village of Gamble. She says according to 10-year average, Gamble gets approximately 675 walrus per year. Savunga gets 578. This year, Gamble got 108. Savunga, a dismal 76. That's just under 20% of the typical walrus harvest.
People are hungry. I feel really pain about it because we depended on heavily on walrus, seal, and bowhead.
Many people on St. Lawrence Island hunt walrus for food and ivory, which they carve and sell to pay bills or exchange wholesale at the village store for essential goods like flour and pilot bread. But this spring, an unusual switch in wind direction brought in especially dangerous hunting weather, clouds, fogs, and snow, and a tightly packed ice floe. James says subsistence hunters simply couldn't get out.
Just hard for the boats to go in. There was no way to go in, even though they've seen so many chunk, walruses, seals. But it was way inside. There was no way to go in.
The region's state legislators, Representative Neil Foster and Senator Donnie Olson, sent a letter to the Parnell administration on Monday, urging the governor to make a disaster declaration to free up state money for relief. They described the impact of the low walrus harvest on St. Lawrence Island as potentially catastrophic. Representative Foster says people probably aren't used to seeing a disaster declaration for subsistence hunting purposes. But a bad ice pack in Gamble will devastate the community just as much as a drought on a farm in the lower 48.
You know, people are out there that are struggling to put food on the table, and I think it's important that, when things are out of their control, for example, the weather and what's happening with the sea ice, that we have some kind of a safety net there to help folks in those times when it's difficult.
David Scott, chief of staff for Senator Olson, says they are hounding Governor Parnell for a quick response. From KNOM in Nome, I'm Eva Dolap.
Still to come on Alaska News Nightly, the Mountain View Community Garden finally breaks ground.
My daughter keeps asking me about the beets and the potatoes because she did help me plant them. And she said, well, when are they ready? When are they ready? I said, honey, we have lots more time to go.
That's ahead. Stay with us.
Alaska News Nightly is brought to you in part by Crowley, celebrating 60 years in Alaska. Crowley knows Alaska and uses that experience to deliver project solutions from concept to completion. More at CrowleyAlaska.com. And by ConocoPhillips, the easy oil is gone and getting to the remaining oil will be a challenge that will require the state and the industry to work together. ConocoPhillips, Alaska's oil and gas company.
The U.S. women's cross-country ski team has never won an Olympic medal, but that could change in Sochi, Russia this winter. Leading the way is Alaska Pacific University skier Keegan Randall, the best sprint skier in the world. Summer training usually involves giving up on snow, but the U.S. women have a secret weapon as they prepare for Sochi, APU's Eagle Glacier training camp. APRN's Annie Feit reports.
Flying up to Eagle Glacier is like taking the longest and most dramatic elevator ride of your life. From Girdwood, it's 6,000 feet nearly straight up. The helicopter barely crests the rocky edge of the glacier and then swoops down over the snow and lands next to a neatly groomed cross-country ski course.
All right, ladies!
APU coach Eric Flora stands at the edge of the course, offering pointers to skiers during a practice speed relay.
Okay, go, 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 go. There we go. Now relax. Look back, look back, look back. Go!
APU runs training camps on the glacier every summer for its Olympic development team and other elite cross-country skiers. The athletes spend a week at a time on the glacier, sleeping and eating in a dorm that sits on shale rock just beyond the snow. They put in long hours skiing each day. On this morning, Flora is watching to see how poppy the skiers look in the legs, as he puts it, among other things.
In the downhills, we're looking for how they take the turns, like the lines they pick, body position, you know, just trying to find different ways to find that extra 2 or 3%. And then just pure racing skills.
Flora designed the course to mimic the Olympic venue in Sochi. The snow is soft, sugary, and wet after baking in the summer sun. But APU skier Keegan Randall says when the team had a chance to test the Sochi course on the World Cup last winter, it felt very familiar.
We all kind of looked at each other and went, this looks just like Eagle Glacier snow. So I think even though it's maybe not the most glorious conditions to ski in, learning how to be technically efficient in this kind of softer snow is going to help us out tremendously in many of the conditions we see on the World Cup.
Randall is the best sprint cross-country skier in the world and the favorite for a gold medal in the event. A decade ago, a top 30 finish for the U.S. was cause for celebration. Now, a handful of U.S. women could medal at the Olympics. The team proved its depth last winter when it won bronze in a four-person relay at a World Cup event in Sweden. APU skier Holly Brooks says it was an incredible moment.
You know, it's funny because you go around town and people are like, yeah, that race you guys won. It's like, well, actually, we didn't win. We got third, but in our minds, we won because nothing like that had ever happened before.
If the U.S. team does bring home a medal from Sochi, Eagle Glacier can take some credit. It's one of the only places in the world where cross-country skiers can train on snow in summer with a place to sleep and eat nearby. Brooke says there's no substitute for skiing on snow.
We roller ski a lot, but actually moving on snow is a totally different feel. It's a different technique. So, you know, as a team and as a group, we're looking to make history. And, you know, this is kind of the groundwork of that history.
The team is obviously focused on the Olympics, but they're trying not to think about it too much. Keegan Randall says she wants to keep her training in business as usual mode.
If you put too much pressure on just that one performance when there's things that could be outside of your control, it could ruin the joy of the journey. And so right now I'm embracing like every day, working towards it. And then if you've done your good work, then you just get out there and do what you always do. And hopefully it's a gold medal moment.
This morning, it's a hunk of glacier moment as Randall and her team win the practice relay. As they catch their breath, Flora scoops up an armload of snow and begins an impromptu award ceremony.
And in first place, being awarded a massive piece of Eagle Glacier ice. You guys are going to have to hold this.
Again!
The team doesn't get much time to enjoy their victory, though. Flora quickly has them back out on the course, putting in more training time on the glacier. In Anchorage, I'm Annie Feit.
The community gardens in the Mountain View neighborhood in Anchorage are finally bearing fruit and vegetables. The Anchorage Community Land Trust negotiated with the municipality to take over the project in 2012 with help from state and grant funding. The organization will host the garden's opening celebration this Friday. APRN's Sarah Bernard reports.
It's hot. Flowers are blooming, vegetables are growing, and tomatoes are actually ripening on the vine in Alaska.
I've been here 54 years, and in that time, I don't remember a summer like this.
Mountain View resident and gardener Kelly McDonald says he's part of the Mountain View Lions Club.
We sponsor Lunchbox for Kids, and that's what I'm doing with these veggies. They're going to that.
The unusually warm summer makes for an opportune time to finally get a community garden project going. The gardens at Bergaw were originally part of a highway overpass and neighborhood redevelopment project, built by the state and managed by the municipality of Anchorage. But McDonald says the gardens have been lying fallow for years.
You had these concrete lines in here and that was it. It just sat here bare for about 4 years.
So the Anchorage Community Land Trust decided to take over. The nonprofit works in the Mountain View neighborhood. Executive Director Jewel Jones says the idea for the gardens came from the Mountain View Community Council, but budgets and administrative issues almost derailed the whole thing.
And there was a point there not too long ago that they were thinking of just ripping up the gardens and getting rid of them.
So we decided that this might be an opportunity for us as a community engagement organization to step in. We had heard a lot from not only the Mountain View community, but we also received endorsements from Northeast, Russian Jack, you know, to let's figure out if we can make this happen.
AmeriCorps Vista volunteer Radhika Krishna will be heading the project until February. She says she began by holding seed starting workshops and community meetings this spring, and now the 44 plots are all full.
The number of people who come here and work, I would say somewhere in the 50 to 60 person range.
One of the people who showed up early and often was local resident Linda Mathis.
I kept checking online about the garden plots. I said, it's not open yet. But yeah, so that's what I was eager, because I wanted to be one of the ones.
Now she's growing a variety of vegetables.
I have collards, cabbage, onion, lettuce, spinach, potatoes, and beets. My daughter keeps asking me about the beets and the potatoes because she did help me plant them. And she said, well, when are they ready? I said, honey, we have lots more time to go. So it's going to be exciting to see the harvest come through.
Ann Mathis says to be part of the gardens is also an opportunity to be part of the neighborhood.
Since I've been out here gardening, actually, I've met several people that comes from the apartments next door and asking questions, what are you doing and what are you growing? So it's a great experience to step out of your boundaries a little bit and begin to know your neighbors a little bit more.
The Anchorage Community Land Trust says it will help provide activities for students and other programming at the gardens. And residents hope it will mark the beginning of many years of homegrown produce. In Anchorage, I'm Sarah Bernard.
Chugiak singer-songwriter Robin Hopper has been named a quarterfinalist in a national competition sponsored by the Grammy Foundation. Hopper, who teaches music at Homestead Elementary in Eagle River, is among more than 200 music teachers competing for the honor of First Music Educator Award, presented by the Recording Academy and the Grammy Foundation.
Just to be at this level is just overwhelmingly wonderful for me. And if I don't get past this, well, this has been really exciting.
The award honors an educator committed to preserving music in the schools. Hopper says her selection for the competition took her by surprise. She had been working in a mentoring program with a former student.
Through our work together in the mentoring program, she decided to nominate me. And when she did that, she didn't tell me. So I got an email from the Grammy folks saying, congratulations, you've been nominated. And about a month later, I got another email from them saying, congratulations, you're now a quarterfinalist, but you can't tell anybody till the press release comes out. And that was a very 2 months long wait to be able to tell anyone.
10 semifinalists will be selected in August. The winner will be announced in December and flown to Los Angeles to attend the Grammys and accept the award.
Alaska News Nightly is brought to you in part by Crowley. Celebrating 60 years in Alaska, Crowley knows Alaska and uses that experience to deliver project solutions from concept to completion. More at CrowleyAlaska.com. Doyon Limited, Interior Alaska's regional native corporation, providing oil field services, government contracting, and natural resource development in Alaska and across the nation. Information at doyon.com. And by Northern Air Cargo. Since 1956, Alaskans have entrusted Northern Air Cargo to transport their freight. Thank you, Alaska, for the opportunity to serve you for decades to come.
A smoking ban planned for state-subsidized senior public housing has been postponed. The Alaska Housing Finance Corporation was to implement no smoking rules in residents' apartments in August, forcing smokers outside. Now the corporation says it will reevaluate the policy. KTOO's Rosemarie Alexander reports.
Who says you can't fight City Hall?
Ron Dean and Catherine Ryan took their fight to the AHFC Board of Directors, corporation managers, a few legislators, even the governor. For now, they've won. Dean and Ryan are smokers who say they will never quit. Dean is author of a petition opposing the no-smoking policy. Ryan helped him gather signatures. About half of Mountain View residents signed, including a lot of non-smokers. Residents in Fairbanks Senior Housing also sent a petition to AHFC.
You know, it was almost a 50-50 split between positive and negative.
Public Housing Division Director Catherine Stone was expecting public comments to track a 2010 survey that showed most residents in senior and disabled facilities wanted a smoke-free policy.
So I think it bears, you know, a little more thought, a little bit more analysis, and a little bit more preparation before we go at it again.
Common areas in AHFC facilities have been non-smoking for years, but the proposed policy said residents would not be allowed to smoke in their own apartments. When AHFC Operations Director Michael Courtney came to Mountain View last week, Ryan and Dean, Ryan in her wheelchair, were smoking outside the back door.
I promised them that I would go and I'd walk the area and chat with residents while I was there.
It was raining, so Ryan and Dean were undercover, close to the rear entrance. The cigarette butt receptacle was at least 10 feet away in the rain.
The picture is worth a thousand words.
Well, honestly, their comments do have something to do with it, and the petition has something to do with it.
Courtney says managers and the AHFC board have been debating the policy for some time, and now is not the time to implement. It will be his job to work with local property managers on a place outside where residents can smoke and still be protected from bad weather. For example, Juneau's Taku Winds or a downpour.
So we've got to have some discussions on what exactly we should do to keep it safe, but at the same time not enclose the smoke so it's going to get into the front of the building.
That's one of the reasons Mountain View resident John Monroe signed the petition 2 months ago. He doesn't smoke, but dreaded groups of smokers outside the entrances.
You come in through that bay, there's 10 people out there smoking. We got to walk through them.
For now, residents in AHFC senior housing across the state will still be able to smoke at home. Housing Division Director Stone says the agency will take the next few months to set up outdoor smoking areas and provide smokers with some help on quitting.
You know, we can have tobacco-free people come and hold classes, or we can provide patches or whatever resources they need and readdress this in the spring.
Ryan says it's not tobacco that will kill her. She has multiple sclerosis and bone disease. She's already digging in her heels for the next time the smoking ban comes around.
It's the only vice I got left, and I'm enjoying it tremendously.
Stone expects AHFC will conduct another survey before rewriting the no smoking policy. In Juneau, I'm Rose Marie Alexander.
Photographer Ron Levy came to Alaska to work as a park ranger during the 1980s. He started taking photos first as a hobby, but soon made the jump to a professional career. Levy has recently returned from Mexico, where he shot photos of environmental degradation. He says he wants to use his camera to help struggling nonprofits accomplish their aims.
I made it kind of a goal of mine about 5, 6, 7 years ago to actively do pursue maybe 2 or 3 projects that help some community or some cause that I believe in and help with my talents combined with other talents. So I like to help the organizations that I've always believed in. And those are either organizations that have to do with our health or the health of the land or the health of animals, which is all basically related. So I've been helping out the American Cancer Society. I've been working with conservation organizations, and that's kind of how this project started in Mexico. I didn't really start it. I came in, you know, kind of midfield here, where they definitely needed some help with promotion and some images to help rally some of the people behind their cause.
How did you hear of them? Through organizations you've already done work with?
No, that's an area that's just above a small pueblo. And the way I heard about it is that I've been coming here for about 20 years because we have some land there and my wife's family lives there. So, or lives nearby there. And they have... Between the last time I visited there last year and this year, they've been fighting this one developer who has pretty much gone ahead and clear-cut 2 or 3 different areas there without permission in an area that was just outside the city limits. And what that means is that it was subject to federal laws, which were already on the books, that protected this area. So... this has been one man who's done this in other places. He's been very intimidating and aggressive towards anybody who's disagreed with him or tried to stop him. So I felt that this was the kind of thing that needs some help.
Was your intention, though, to call attention to the environmental degradation or to see if you could get some kind of penalty thrown at this fellow?
Yeah, exactly. He was able to bribe some officials there to write letters, one letter in particular, where a couple of them went out with him and he showed him the land that he had already cut. And astonishingly enough, they wrote a letter that said, we don't see any problem here, there are no trees, and therefore he didn't cut any down. And as absolutely ridiculous as that sounds, that's exactly what they said. One, I want to broaden this out to a larger audience. This is a small pueblo here. The people are dealing with their own issues of family. They don't have the money or, in many ways, the backbone to stand up to somebody who is physically, emotionally aggressive and intimidating. And if we can't find support in Mexico, perhaps there are groups in other countries, either nearby or the U.S., that can provide some sort of advice or help.
Clear cutting is only going to impact the drinking water and create a health issue for the human population. And can you tell me a little more about that?
The forest is a lot more than trees. It's a water supply for the community. To approach this on not only a cosmetic basis, but a utilitarian basis, I think is the right way to go. And again, the issue is generating that concern from a health standpoint so the people can relate to it, the people locally and the people in other countries. That's what I hope to do in getting the photos published. Once we get the word around in enough places, we'll start generating the concern from the public and hopefully from editors and companies that are involved in these types of Good Samaritan pro bono issues.
Alaska photographer Ron Levy. And that's all for this edition of Alaska News Nightly. If you missed any of tonight's stories, we're online at alaskapublic.org. We had reports tonight from Eva DeLapp in Nome, Rosemarie Alexander in Juneau. APRN's Peter Granitz reported from Washington, D.C., and Sarah Bernard from Anchorage. Our editor and producer is Annie Feit. Our audio engineer is Kristen Spack. Josh Edge is our web producer. I'm Ellen Lockyer.
Alaska News Nightly was made possible by Arctic Wire Rope and Supply, an Alaskan company providing lifting and rigging products since 1983, on the web at arcticwirerope.com. The Alaskan Nanook Commission reminds you that harassing polar bears or taking polar bears with cubs is not only illegal, but it is not part of Native traditions. Together with their management partners at the U.S. Fish and Wildlife Service, the Alaska Nanook Commission has been working on developing a long-term polar bear deterrence plan to protect Alaska's villages from dangerous polar bear encounters. More at the AlaskaNanookCommission.org. This message sponsored by the Alaska Nanook Commission, Alaska's people managing Alaska's resources. How do you get men to wear a life jacket when the fact is that 90% of those who die in boating accidents in Alaska are men? Well, most men won't listen to this message, but they might listen to you. So have them pledge to wear a life jacket every time they get in a boat. Every time. Have them fill out a Pledge to Live card at pledgetolive.org. That's pledgetolive.org. Make them promise so they make it back home. This message sponsored by the Alaska Office of Boating Safety.
This is APRN, the Alaska Public Radio Network.